Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and today my guest is Chris Kander. She's the author of a novel called The Weight of a Piano, and it's from Knopf. Now, as I read this book, I became more and more drawn into its passion. It's a passionate book. A piano travels through a couple of generations of owners. What's the name of the piano makers?
A Blüthner.
And what's special about that piano?
Everything is special about a Blüthner piano. When I was deciding which kind of piano to put in this book, I was led to a woman in Los Angeles who is a dealer of Blüthner pianos. And I discovered that they have what is called a peerless golden tone and are very special, quite uncommon in the United States, and are revered by classical pianists, though, all over the world.
We begin the novel, The Weight of a Piano, in a dense forest in the Romanian mountains where a piano maker is watching trees being sliced with the idea that they will be the music board for his piano. And he chooses very, very carefully, even once things have been sent to his shop, they get rejected. It is said in the course of the book that these pianos remember every piece of music that's ever been played on them, that there is a kind of special softness to the wood, to the closeness of the rings on the tree, that they are almost themselves like recording devices. A photographer sees an advertisement for this piano. Again, the name?
Blüthner.
And he puts in a bid. He increases the bid, even increases it to the extent that he will pay the entire sum for 1 week's borrowing the piano because his mother, who was dead, played this piano. It was her salvation during a difficult marriage. Well, the person who owns the piano does not play it, but it is an inheritance from her father. And we are going to discover this piano bringing people together in the oddest and most emotional ways. Now tell me, I understand that you do not play the piano. How did you understand the connection that a piano brings between people?
Correct that I don't play and have never been able to play the piano, but I have always been a music lover, and I'm always fascinated by the way that experiencing music, whether alone or together with other people, creates such an emotional response. And it wasn't a stretch for me to understand that those people who are fortunate enough to be able to make music must have a special reverence to those instruments that allow them to express their creative ideas, similar to how I might feel about a favorite pen, for example. So I could transfer that level of appreciation and affection to a piano, even though I don't know what it's like to express myself through the action of piano's keys.
It's very beautiful because the heroine of this novel, whose name is...
Clara.
And it's a very tricky thing because there's another woman in the novel named...
Katya.
Katya. And I have to say that I was reading one through the other until I discovered that that was correct, that there's a kind of magical superimposition of these two women. But Clara, whose parents are dead, has been taught by an uncle how to repair cars. She's very good at it, and she's proud, in a sense, of having a job that is not a womanly job. The opposite pole would be if she were a mistress, so to speak, of the musical arts, where, you know, as a piano player, she would be quite an aesthete, a bohemian, very feminine, and she travels between these poles in this book until she can discover who she is.
Yes.
And each of these poles, the automobile repair person and the pianist, has an accompanying man. A man, cameraman, artist, photographer, who wants to take pictures of this piano because his mother played that make of piano, and maybe, lo and behold, this very one.
Yes.
His mother committed suicide where?
In Death Valley National Park.
In Death Valley National Park. Where the photographer brings the borrowed piano, photographing it at the edges of ledges of cliffs, high, low,
yes,
from above, from below, until the piano is sort of like his mother's body. In this novel, The Weight of a Piano, by my guest, Chris Kander, C-A-N-D-E-R, is a very unusual and passionate novel because all of its characters have fixations on objects, on each other, on ways of life, even on foods.
Mm-hmm. And on memories.
Memories,
and
yes.
And on ideas of their own identities and their struggles to express or shed those identities, as it were.
Do I remember correctly? Is the piano 560-some pounds?
560, yes.
And not only that, but this piano has to be retuned every time it's moved.
Yes.
It's very, very delicate.
By the time we meet this piano in the novel, and I do think of it as a character,
it is,
in the book, it's more than 100 years old, and so has become delicate, but also has become freighted by its history, an accumulation of a lifetime of memories of people having played it or not played it, having lost it, having acquired it, having stored it, all of these things. And so by the time we meet the piano, it is in a condition that's unstable.
And in the second to last chapter, the piano is an old lady.
Yes.
The piano really has cracks that have been inflicted both by age, and in one case, a husband is so jealous of his wife's love of the piano that he scars both the piano and his son.
Yes.
With a poker. The son limps. The piano contains the vestiges of that attack, which takes the form of a marital disagreement. And I would say that this is, can I say it? The most abstractly emotional novel I've ever read. But it's very abstract. Did you mean it to be so?
I was not intentional about that idea. I was merely following my own exploration of what it means to be attached to something passionately and what it means to lose that and how it affects our sense of self and our sense of history. And so it was just exploring those ideas in the form of a particularly heavy object, in this case, a literally and metaphorically heavy object, that it did become a little abstract.
There are two people who, in the terms of romantic fiction, are perfect for one another. But perfection is not perfection. Perfection only looks like perfection. And the heroine, Clara, has to pull herself out of the story that's winding itself around her and is almost lassoing her to this man who looks like the perfect man for her, except it's so obvious that he's not. Mm-hmm. Because every time she strays from his sense of perfection, he ropes her back in, and we see that he's going to make her his prisoner.
And I think because it's not really about the romantic involvement between the characters, it's really an exploration of the romantic connection we have to our idealized sense of self. And so this kind of unraveling that you're referring to between these two characters, Clara and Greg, it's more about her recognizing that the narrative that she's been told and that she's been telling herself, and simultaneously the narrative that Greg has adhered to, are not the right stories, that neither of them needs to be pursuing these destinies that they think that they are yoked to.
It's sort of as if you were reading Wuthering Heights and you became aware that the whole nature of the book would be to prove to Heathcliff and, is it Catherine, that they're not right for each other, that the monstrousness, the terror at the heart of that love affair is something that the two of them can escape. Mm-hmm. And so what I found wonderful about The Weight of a Piano is that by the final chapter, and here there will be no spoiler, I promise, the characters who are together are the characters who should be together. They may not be intellectually together. They may not be bohemians or music lovers or piano players, but he knows her favorite kind of cookie. His mother bakes that kind of cookie, and it's the small things.
Yes.
Not the weight of a piano, but the weight of a cookie.
Right.
Bag. Exactly.
And unburdening themselves of these various kinds of weights is an essential part of how I kind of explore my own, you know, life. It's not only in the writing of this book, but just in the way that we attach ourselves to ideas and people. I feel like getting to the truth of where are we supposed to be? Who are we supposed to be friends with? Who are we supposed to be in love with?
You know, that's who are we really?
Who are we really?
Who are we really? Is there anything wrong with a female garage mechanic?
Not a thing.
Who fits right into the family of garage mechanics
exactly.
that she's joined? And this is such an interesting thing because it's an anti-book.
Mm.
It's a book that says, oh, forget about all your storytelling about the rightness, the perfection of things. That's all stories. That's what stories are. Life is who you can feel fit next to and accept, despite the fact that they may not be Prince Charming or your dream come true. So tell me, when you were writing The Weight of a Piano, were there other books that you were thinking about that work like this, that are about pulling their presuppositions apart?
I love that you called it an anti-book. I can't say that I had another book in my mind that was like this. I of course, am influenced by everything I have ever read. But really, I was just, in my mind, most intently thinking about how to shed light on what is overlooked, what is often overlooked. I try to do that in all of my books, is to look at the things that other people are uncomfortable looking at. And in this case, it took the form of, you know, literally this piano and the story that was attached to it. But I think that as far as how it came to be shaped and structured, it was just about looking carefully at the uncomfortable things.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Chris Kander about her new novel, The Weight of a Piano. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Chris Kander about her new novel, The Weight of a Piano, in which a piano ties the lives of two people together. Well, more than two. The characters are being joined over time and continents for better or worse, and we think we know what kind of book this is when it throws up its hands and says, now stop it. You all know that you only read about this kind of thing in books. What about life? What about the difficulties of life? What about the difficulties and the lack of perfection
mm-hmm.
of life? And that's what struck me as being thrilling and unusual about this book. Everyone in it comes to know that the thing they thought they wanted was an illusion, just something that takes place in Death Valley, but we live in life.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for saying those kind things about it. And as setting it in Death Valley was such an interesting opportunity to juxtapose these ideas of life and death, love and loss, music and silence. In fact, I think that the whole book is filled with these dichotomies, and exploring the breadth of it all, I wanted to balance it out. That's why it's balanced between the voices of the two female protagonists chapter by chapter. And as they struggle with these ideas, it allowed me to think about how I feel about these ideas, not just about telling the story, but about living life. How do we live with our losses? How do we find truth in ourselves? How do we come back to the passions that we know are present in our lives?
In the acknowledgments to the book, which are longer than usual,
yes.
The final sentence is, finally, I send gratitude and endless love to my husband, Harris, for being always at my side. And you get the feeling that this is what Clara had been afraid of, that there'd be someone always at her side, and she's been accused of having to run away. And by the end of the book, she seems to have decided that it wouldn't be so bad. Maybe it won't be a romantic, limping, Byronic hero, but it will be a someone, and she is going to make an exploration to see if romance can come later and love follow it. But what if we were to live in the real world?
Mm-hmm.
What if we were to eschew all of this style, complexity of storytelling, shifting of characters left? I mean, I was very impressed.
Thank you.
By how you did that all, but still more impressed by your saying, let's stop it.
Yes.
That's just writing. Let's see what we can do. Let's see how this book can really end so that your heart is still broken, but not permanently.
But there's hope.
But there's hope.
There's hope. Yes. Yeah. I wanted to offer a sense of possibility, which, you know, is important in this book throughout, but I felt like it was important to end that way too.
I don't want to be intrusive, but is Harris that kind of discovery for you?
We've been married for 21 years this year. He has been that person. He is stable and wonderful. And when I discovered him, I knew right away that he was the one that I wanted to be by my side for the rest of my life. And he has turned out to be that way. And so the relationships in the novel are sort of all, I think, straining toward an idealized version. And when in reality, something as beautifully perfect as being by someone's side during the best and worst of times is, I think, an amazing goal.
And so in the strangest way imaginable, this ends as a realistic novel. Or this chooses the real world over the Russian world.
The idealized, fantastical.
The moody, fantastical.
Yes.
You know, yes.
Yes, very much. Finding a sense of place, finding a sense of home. And that home, you know, is important not just physically. And that idea of home is a recurrent theme throughout the story as well.
Yes.
But a home within oneself. A truth to that discovery of identity. That is a sense of returning to home, too.
Now, tell me, you've written a novel full of intensity and passion, and a novel which, in its final chapter, is going to jettison those things. When did you become sure that you could convince a reader to go with the road not taken?
Yes. I don't know that I ever decided that I was capable of convincing the reader, but I hoped that I could bring them along for the ride, because that decision to end it the way that I did felt very natural to me. By the time I knew the characters well enough, it felt like the, in fact, only possible way to conclude this portion of their story.
Well, to me too. But you see, you're the novelist, so you know what you're doing. I'm the reader for whom nearly everything is a surprise.
Yes.
So in those last 12 or 13 pages, I'm going, oh, and then, oh, again, oh, I get. Oh, my God, the right man was really the wrong man.
Serious.
Really, look at him ordering her around. Look at him making her believe that she can be substituted by an old piano, that she can play the role of his mother, not his wife. Oh, oh, oh. Well, poor both of them, and lucky Clara that yes. the right man is on hand.
Yes, and here is a little insider information. I don't always know what I'm doing, and I too can be surprised even as I'm writing. And that certainly was true in the case of this story. I was surprised and moved by their choices many times along the way.
Well, you convinced me, you see, over and over again, because you move from description to dialogue, and often the dialogue, you have an inner ear for it.
Thank you.
And the dialogue convinces us, oh, the storytelling was the lie. This is how these people really talk to one another, and this is no way to talk. Listen, this is the first time I've had Chris Kander on. This is her first novel from what they call a mainstream press. I've never even heard of the two smaller presses that published your first two books, but I'm happy to own them now. I'm particularly looking forward to reading the one called 11 Stories. It's a novel.
Yes.
The building in it has 11 stories. You can tell she's that kind of writer, always finding the alternative to the obvious. It was a pleasure to read her and a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for coming.
It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for inviting me on.
I've been talking with Chris Kander, author of The Weight of a Piano, published by Knopf. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, really wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, you can listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. And if you go to the Bookworm archive on the KCRW website, you can listen to practically all 30 years of Bookworm programs. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are